Hello and welcome to the Limos, the podcast between. This week I'm talking to the author Ken Ami.
My crew doesn't need a rest. My life doesn't need no other. There's a rock inside my chest. Hey, 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 oh, hey, hey.
I guess I wanted to start with the generalities more than the specifics. Maybe we'll get into it and all the things you've explored and uncovered there, but I'd like to start with a more general subject of entertainment media. I've just finished a book about Hollywood and movies, and I won't even try to describe it, but it's been quite an exhausting and exhaustive work. And one of the dilemmas that I'm faced with is that essentially one of my motivations for writing this book has been to try and break the spell that I feel that Hollywood has over me and has since I was a kid, and I feel that, you know, by really examining and looking at more closely the way in which that spell works, I might be able to break it. But there's a kind of conundrum in that, or even a psychic, a Chinese psychic trap, in that, of course, it means that I'm all the more compelled to look at the media because I'm studying it now. I mean, I always have studied it, but now I'm studying it in this particular way. So I just wanted to ask you about that. Like, how do you feel about mainstream Hollywood and TV entertainment? It seems that you watch a lot of it and you analyze it and deconstruct it. Do you also watch it for entertainment, and are you conflicted about that?
Typically, I find that I'm able to, let's say a movie, okay, I'm able to watch it with almost two brains. One of them is just enjoying the show, and the other one is examining and discerning and thinking and noticing and seeking to dissect it.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, I might find a movie enjoyable or interesting, but I don't let it sort of take charge of me or lead me down the road of a philosophy that I can just easily accept because, well, hey, I've seen 100 movies with the same message, so it must be true, it must be normative, it must be acceptable, that sort of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is part of it. I am very empathetic to what you're saying, is you're recognizing that it is a propaganda device. And so now you're looking at it even more intently in order to discern the propaganda and how it functions and what the propaganda is. So that it is, it's almost like a catch 22.
Yeah, because I think I've always been aware that there was, well, maybe not always, not as a kid, but since my 20s, reading Pauline Kael and whatnot. Like, I love Dirty Harry, but I read her review of Dirty Harry, and she described it as police propaganda. So I understood at a very young age, that would have been 15 or less, that element. And I'd say I understand it more and more, but one of the things I've come to understand that I certainly didn't understand back then is that it's there are different levels of propaganda, and it's like the medium and the message, right? There's the propaganda that is the message, and then there's the propaganda that is the medium, and that is the what does actually the act of watching this stuff do to us? What does it do to our brains and our bodies? By submitting to narratives in this way, like almost independently of the content of the narratives, if you see what I mean. Because it's, I mean, if so far as we're getting into a story, we're allowing our brain to mirror, our mirror neurons to fire so that we empathize with the characters and so that we let the narrative transport us into that virtual realm, and then our body is having these physiological responses. So that's kind of where I've become, like, is this actually almost like a literal drug? As in, every time I watch it, I become more, intoxicated and more dependent on it.
Yes, one of the things that I mentioned in this book is that, in a sense, the way that we watch movies, particularly big Hollywood productions that are shown at movie theaters, it is a form of sensory deprivation, in a manner of speaking, whereas you could also term it sensory overload. I mean, it kind of depends how you look at it. So, in other words, yes, you're sitting perfectly still, your body's very relaxed. Your brain can just literally go on neutral and coast, and you're being bombarded with visual and audio clues in an environment that's dark. So one thing I talk about in this book is Plato's allegory of the cave, if you're aware of that. That is essentially our modern day movie theaters. You are staring at a gigantic screen. You don't look away from it, because why would you? There's nothing else to see. There's images being portrayed before you that are a simile of reality, a literal virtual reality. And if you are one of the captives, I mean, in the allegory of the cave, that actually manages to escape from the cave, and you're pointing at the cave saying, look, it's just a cave, it's a put on, it's contrived reality, then those who have been in the cave will tell you things such as, like, hey, it's just a movie, and that's it, that's the end of it. Whereas, yes, in ancient times, I know it's hard to believe, but they didn't have multimedia, so people would sit around campfires and hear great mythical and legendary tales of heroism and ethics and philosophy. And well, we don't do that anymore, but our equivalent of it is screens of various size, large movie screens, television screens, cell phone screens. And so that is really the same sort of scenario, except the high-tech version. And this is why, for instance, when I've lectured on cosmological multiverse theory, I said, well, how many people believe in multiverse theory because they've really studied the peer-reviewed journal papers written about it, versus how many believe it because it's in so many movies that it's easy to just say, oh yeah, I could totally see that, sure, why not? And that goes with a thousand other things. Unethical behavior, drug use, who knows? You just fill in the blank with virtually anything. And it makes you think, well, this stuff is normal. You know, the Hollywood lifestyle, that's normal. It's the celebrity lifestyles, that's, we think it might be strange because we don't have the level of funds to fund lavish lifestyles like that, but sleeping around and drugs and all that, hey, that's the way to be. This is where we're getting all these ideas.
So you're referring there to two layers of myth making, which I also identify in my book right at the start. That there's the movie, the narratives of the movies themselves, and then there's the narratives that are created around Hollywood and the movie stars and their lives, which are probably not quite equally fictionalized, but still with a large element of fictionalization in them.
I mean, for instance, when I attend a church service for a mere hour per week, I really enjoy it for what it is. But can I say that my pastor's standing there motionless, speaking to me, is as captivating as a multi-million dollar movie with special effects, with people who were expertly trained in lighting and setting and acting and sound and everything? So in other words, it's a much more engaging vehicle or format via which to present messages to us, worldviews, philosophies. There's really no way around the fact that anything that you see on a screen has some sort of worldview or philosophy behind it.
Some kind of what philosophy?
Worldview, worldview philosophy. It's unavoidable. And so that's why people like us sit around and think, okay, well, what is it? What is it that we're being told through this?
Well, and also, what's the fundamental appeal of? Because I mean, the appeal of storytelling, of course, as you pointed out, goes very far back, both in our lives as individuals and collectively as a species. Like, storytelling is so fundamental to our experience and how we construct. Maybe I don't want to say construct, because it's not how we construct reality, but how we interpret and how we interact with reality. Storytelling is very fundamental to that. It's actually a way to make the incoherent more coherent, or make, you know, a vast sea of information and stimuli into something that's comprehensible to us, and then help us to navigate through it. So fairy tales for children helps them to navigate childhood and, you know, grow into adulthood, and that's always been around. And for me, it was, for most of us now, it was movies. And that, it's like the Jesuits saying, you know, if you give me a child when it's young and I'll give you the man. If we're introduced to screens at a very young age, then even leaving aside for a moment the way that changes our brains and whatnot, we get completely acclimatized to that parasocial reality, that way of relating to screens and stories. So that's the one of the things I've been examining, like trying to go as far back into my childhood. And some of my very earliest memories are of watching movies with my mother, for example. So for me, watching a movie is associated with being with my mother and being in this safe place, like a second womb, which is, you know, very much what movies are like The Matrix. They, like you're saying, they take us into this disembodied realm. So, as a parent, just to keep it personal, how do you feel about letting your children watch TV and movies? Do you have a policy on that?
Yeah, so let me just make a statement before that, which is what storytelling also does is it alerts us to symbolism. So, for instance, when I wrote a book about the Alien and Predator franchises, I ran across that the original script for Alien was going to be called, the original scriptwriter said a better title would have been The Haunted Spaceship, because he said that it was about a supernatural menace. Okay, now you could watch all the Alien movies and you would not get that idea that it had anything to do with the supernatural. And maybe it's because they dropped that as a concept, or maybe it's because what we're thinking of as a biological entity that we call an alien is really a stand-in for that supernatural menace. And so that is the sort of thing that people like us need to think about is, okay, on the surface level, the movie is about A, but I can see a level beneath it, it's really about B, and then maybe there's a C and D under that. So one of the challenges for me is always to try to discern the context. Where is this coming from? And that will help me interpret what I perceive to be the symbolism in it. Hmm. Now, as far as me personally being a parent, it is essentially impossible to control everything my kids see, but we definitely have systems in place to, you know, beginning at a young age, restrict, and as they get older, discuss things with them. They understand that there's a message behind anything they're seeing on a screen. And from the sorts of things that they tell me, especially my oldest boy, inevitably, if we watch a movie together, the second it's done, he's talking to me about, oh, you know, I see how they're trying to say this, and I really like the way they did this. And so he's really thinking about it. He's really, I would imagine he's much like me, watching the movie for what it is, but then also having this area in the active area in the part of our brain really discerning it. And so that's really the only way I've been able to figure out how to not have them live in a electronics-free bubble, which is never going to happen, but how to help them engage it.
So, I mean, this is another broad question, but one of the things that I've been unable to really reconcile or reach any kind of conclusion about is the difference between art and propaganda. Because clearly, well, it's clear to me anyway, that we're talking about a spectrum here and not a polarity. Like, really good propaganda is artful. And there, and I would say, I mean, I used to think about it more as a polarity, that something like Top Gun is obviously propaganda, something like The Godfather is art. But as the years have gone by, and as I've become more conscious and more aware of the nuances of these things, I've had to see, and also looking at the deep background of something like The Godfather. Like, with Top Gun, it's very obvious that it was made as a military recruiting propaganda piece, but if you look at the background of The Godfather, you also see that the mob was involved in getting The Godfather made. So it was mob propaganda, at least they thought it was going to be good for them in some way, and I think we can say that it was. And yet we can also say, maybe I would say, that The Godfather is a work of art and Top Gun is just, you know, crap basically, but it's effective propaganda. So it, to me, that raises a really profound question, like, has there ever been a pure kind of art? And if so, you know, what is it? So what are your thoughts about that? Like, how do you feel about the difference between art and propaganda? Or do you make a difference? Or how do you feel about art in general in this context that you're looking at movies?
I suppose I would say maybe we can distinguish between aspects of propaganda. So it's easy to say propaganda and it strictly sounds sinister, where it could be propaganda such as I'm thinking it literally because my first language is Spanish, and in Spanish, a TV commercial, it's propaganda.
Right.
So I'm thinking, okay, I put on TV commercials saying that, hey, we have a homeless shelter and we could use some donations. Okay, well, that's propaganda, but it's not sinister or malicious. So I would say that art is inevitably propagandistic in whichever direction you might take it, because there's no way for a person to produce art. And I'm going to suppose that by art, we mean very many formats, from painting to tea to movies to books, any kind of artistic art form, that it's literally impossible for a person to produce neutral art. For instance, if I were to sit down and write a fictional story, I would have to, by necessity and by definition, put something of my own real life worldview philosophy into it. Because if not, the art would be so absolutely abstract that it would be something incommunicable. It would be, I don't even know how to put it, because it's so hard to conceive of something. And the bottom line being, let's say that I purposely set out to produce a piece of art, and I set my mind to not portraying any of my worldview or philosophy in it. No messages, no moral. I'm going to make it completely meaningless. Well, then guess what? It's nihilism. I mean, so even if you set out to not do it, you're still doing it because it's unavoidable.
Right.
The minute you conceive of doing it, it already has a meaning.
So what do you respond to then as a, well, let's keep it on movies and TV shows. I mean, I don't want to make this quite as simple as what do you like? You know, what are your favorite shows? Because obviously we could go down a rabbit hole with that. But what do you respond to? How do you gauge a sense of integrity or honesty from a work, and do you have a criteria for that that you've developed over the years?
Well, I think there's a difference between the kind of movies I would watch because I know I'm going to be interested in the storyline and the kind of movies I may quote unquote watch more like a filler. So, for instance, I remember one time my wife wanted their TV remote that I had and I didn't want to give it to her, not. I wasn't being mean about it, but and she said, "You can't type on the computer and play guitar and watch TV at the same time." And I told her, "Well, yeah, I can." So I do find a lot of times I'll be doing some research and then I'll have the TV on in the background just as noise, basically. And what I found is, in order to deal with what sometimes is a short attention span, if I'm doing more than one thing at once, then when my attention span wanders, it has something to latch onto while I'm still focused on what I really want to be focusing on, if that makes any kind of sense. So maybe the auditory part of my brain is listening to, or at least picking up sound waves, but then my brain's really focused on my research and things like that. So I may watch a lot of movies that I don't really pay attention to, but there are some that I watch because I am particularly curious in a certain director or a certain actor because they seem to be doing very specific things in their art. And so the concept of, okay, what are they doing this time? What are they getting us into this time? I'll give you an example. Actually, you might look into this movie. It's a very recent one called Color from Space.
I just watched it actually,
Okay, so now, did you recognize the director?
yeah, that was why I watched it. Well, it's because of you actually, and it's
Okay,
not coincidental because you put me onto him. And I there was something I like about his way of speaking, so I've been listening to quite a lot of his interviews, and so then one thing led to another and I watched the movie.
interesting, because I also like to listen to him just for his cadence and all that and his
Yeah.
accent. But so you have Richard Stanley, who is some level of occultist. I really don't know exactly what he's into. It's a movie based on Lovecraft, and it stars Nicolas Cage. I mean, that is a trifecta of occultism right there. Not to mention the movie begins with an occult magic ritual on top of it. With the connection, incidentally, of something falling from the skies, and then even within the movie, somebody asked the young magic practitioner if she thinks that this came about because of her ritual. So you have this connection between an occult ritual and something. I always think of it in terms of what Jesus said: "I beheld Satan fall to earth like lightning." And so that oftentimes, actually, exactly as it is in the novel, it that is exactly how it came to Earth. So, okay, so is it some kind of alien, or is that symbolic of a satanic presence type of thing? So, anyhow, I thought to mention that. But so yeah, I would definitely have a preference for something that seems to be attempting to make a philosophical case, and I tend to like paranormal type storylines, because that kind of walks the line between the material world and the other realm.
So, but do you not feel conflicted then in that regard, as far as I mean, it's coming back to my initial question. I mean, presumably you're drawn to watch Richard Stanley's Color Out of Space and to research Richard Stanley largely because he is an occultist, and I presume, well, I don't want to presume too much, but do you see that there's a complicity there, it's quite meta, as in like a movie itself can be a ritual. No, we sit down in the dark and we watch the movie, and the images and the sounds and all the rest of it generate responses in our own psyche. And so you could say it's a kind of conjuring, but without going all the way there to that possibility, do you see somebody like Richard Stanley as a practicing occultist, as somebody who might actually be doing something that is demonic or is satanic in its essence?
It is quite possible, although I have the very same feeling of caution about almost everything in the world around us, from the big corporations to their products to their commercials to, like we said, the propaganda to what is being done to us through so-called medicines, and you name it. There's always a potential for that sort of thing to be in the background, if not quite bluntly in the foreground. I mean, when Madonna refers to the Super Bowl halftime performance as quote-unquote the Holy of Holies, now I can't get it into her brain to really know what she personally meant by that, but to people like us, it's very obvious that that is absolutely a form of ritual, and probably the most watched one in the world at the time that it's being presented. So for me, a big part of it is knowing what I believe, knowing who is my protector, and knowing that there is an actual absolute truth, and anything that opposes it is by definition false. And thereby being able to live in this world where every time I look one way or the other, there is something attempting to either propagandize or deceive or attack or who knows what.
So when you initially sent me that quote from Richard Stanley about how he really wanted to traumatize audiences, and what was your response to that when you heard him say that? Like, how did you understand that?
Actually, the book that we're going to talk about tonight, I begin it with a lengthy quotation from Stanley that includes that one, but also a very, very lengthy one about how he personally discerns what Hollywood is doing as Gnosticism, Gnostic propaganda. And the way I took that particular quotation is, I think, like I might have mentioned to you in the email, well, I guess you got to have gold. I mean, to me, it would be so unnatural for me to even conceive of something like that, that a big goal in my life is to really traumatize people. I mean, where your head has to be, much less your soul, to even conceive of something like that, and then to state it publicly, like, hey, everybody, just so you know, in my capacity as a director, this is one of my big goals in life. That, I think, really tells you something about a person. What exactly, precisely it tells you, again, I would have to be in his head, but it tells me that he's definitely got priorities that are extremely different than mine are, at the very least.
You when you're around. So please take a stand and show some balls. I might return some of your calls. Your calls. But I will always listen to you.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, I mean, as you were pointing out with the Super Bowl, if one were listening to Steven Spielberg, or I don't know who would be, you know, the opposite end of the pole here, and they were saying, you know, my goal is to bring more compassion into the world and to help people love one another, I wouldn't necessarily find that less demonic, you know, depending on who it was coming from, no? So that is interesting. I mean, because when you sent me the quote, that was where I went with it. Like, oh, well, that's really dark, and that really confirms some of the things I've been mapping in my book, like the continuum between Dadaism and the theater of cruelty and Anton Artaud and these kind of things, and surrealism with the Hollywood movies today, and this torture porn and all the rest of it, the aesthetics of terror. That was where I went with it. But then when I actually listened to him saying it, and the guy was laughing, and it was, you know, a horror film geek, I realized that even though I might have been right, that might well be true, there's another level, which is more at a conscious level. This is a guy who wants to make horror movies, and of course horror movies are supposed to terrify people, and people pay money for that, and so that was the context he was saying that, right? He wants to make a horror movie that's really effective. And so in that sense, it says more about the culture than, or as much about the culture as the individual, you know, that we actually live in a world where we do pay to be traumatized. Not really, I don't think movies do really traumatize us, but to be, have our senses assaulted so severely that, you know, we can be psychically compromised, let's say, by them.
Yes, you're reminding me of a statement made by C.S. Lewis to the effect of, wouldn't you think that there was something extremely wrong with a culture where a group of people gathered in a room and then there was a plate on a table and then a cupboard, and then the cover was lifted and there's a piece of bacon on the plate and everybody was just ooed and awed, right? Mm-hmm. You would think that there was something fundamentally wrong with that culture's conception of food.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, yes, we're doing the same exact thing with so many things, such as being terrorized, seeking that out. And then I'm sure you'll recall how you and I also watched the video interview with Clive Barker and John Carpenter, if I remember correctly, with Dr. Ruth,
mm-hmm.
and how they're explaining that they try to think back to childhood and what things terrorized us as children and then put that into their movies because they know that will be that will strike the audience at such a fundamental level of literally traumatizing them with regards to the fears that they had in childhood, a most vulnerable time where it's really difficult to even handle our emotions, much less make sense of our fears. And these are the things that they want to tap into because they know it'll be effective. And maybe we would even seek that out, like you said, watching movies, sitting there with your mom.
Hmm.
Right. So, okay, maybe I'm watching a movie and it's scaring me, but there's something going on at a different level where I'm tapping into my childhood memories. my most fundamental formative years, perhaps.
It was a horror movie, actually. My earliest memory of a movie, it was Day of the Triffids, watching it with my mother, and she was there to.
Oh yes. Well, let me tell you, when I was a teenager, I watched Clockwork Orange with my mom.
Yeah.
And as we were watching it, I kept thinking, oh, I forgot that scene was in there. This is super uncomfortable.
Right, the rapes, yeah.
But I wanted to mention to you a 1959 movie called The Tangler.
Yeah, the William Castle thing that they've wired the seats for, yeah.
Well, what was fascinating about it is the advertisements for the movie were essentially a challenge to your manhood, right? It really was propagandistic in the form that it challenged and encouraged the audience to become emotionally involved with the storyline they were seeing on the screen. So part of the storyline of the movie is that there's this creature called the Tangler, and it can attach to you and cause, you know, all kinds of problems, including death. And the way that to scare it off is you scream as loud as you possibly can. And so that's the movie, but that's what was being told to the audience. When you're in the movie theater and it gets to a point in the movie where you're scared, yell out as loudly as humanly possible right there in the theater. And so to me, that is a very telling aspect of how to really draw in the audience so that they're not merely passively watching a story, and then when it's done, they're going to crack their knuckles and walk out of the theater, but to really become emotionally involved. In fact, I have a friend who is very much into the IT world, writing code and programs and all this, and he says, yeah, I don't like dealing with video game companies because of the kind of things that they do, which, for example, is hiring psychologists in order to learn how to get people as addicted to their video games as possible.
Right.
Concepts such as make sure something's with every few seconds, something is happening on the screen, or like the concept that Coppola talked about in movies, which is make sure something drastic happens every 15 minutes, right? Anything you can do to make sure that the person's attention doesn't waver away for too long and it's constantly drawn back. And one thing I've noticed too is that we tend to build emotional relationships with people who cause us to have emotional responses. Now, they could be good or bad. Right, somebody makes me laugh. Oh man, that guy's a funny guy. I enjoy hanging out with. Or this person's a jerk. Oh man, they really. You know, so whatever it is, we tend to do that, and so we're doing that with how is it that we end up saying that we love celebrity X, even though we've never met them, and most of what we've seen is just literally a persona, literally them acting unlike themselves because the script calls for it.
Yeah. Yeah, and that extends to the movies themselves, as in a movie causes a profound emotional relationship.
Right.
I mean, reaction, and so we get imprinted by it, and we get bonded to it. So you were saying about John Carpenter and Wes Craven and those other horror directors going back to their childhood, and the kind of assumption at first is that it's just normal. They're horror filmmakers who just want to make scary movies, so then they go back to their childhood to find something scary. That just seems like a normal procedure, but actually, I think it's much deeper, as you're implying. William Friedkin also talked about this in his autobiography. He begins it, actually, interesting, he quotes Jolly West, the MK Ultra doctor who he was associated with, but that's a parapolitical deep background. The anecdote he gives is simply that he was absolutely terrified at the movies with his mother as a child, and ever since that time he decided he wanted to inflict that experience on other people. He doesn't put it quite like that. he puts it in the context of, realizing he wanted to make movies. But essentially, I think he's describing it more honestly when he's implying that he was traumatized and so he wanted to pass that trauma on to other people. And that's how it works, right? We get imprinted by trauma and we can't bear the tension and the anxiety and the charge that we're carrying around, and so then we try and take it out on others.
And then another aspect of, you're right, the interview was between Wes Craven, Clive Barker, and Dr. Ruth. And one thing she talks to them about is this concept of that you're in a movie theater, you took a young lady there, and when she gets scared, guess what? She's going to cuddle up to you. You're going to put your arm around her. And so there's this extremely disturbing correlation that takes place between sensuality or sexuality and trauma and horror and terror, all mixed in together.
Right. Yeah, well, I think that's another of those things that the psychologists have worked out and figured out how to weaponize, isn't it? Is that if we get reminded of our death, we become horny. We want to have sex because there's that eros and thanatos relationship. Like that death anxiety causes the libido to get extra fired up as a defense against it.
And I mean, that would explain why so many horror movies, especially B movies, are essentially a mixture of horror and let's just call it softcore porn.
Yeah.
I mean, one scene, someone is getting their head lopped off, and the next one, there's a scantily clad young woman.
Or it could even be the scantily clad woman having her head chopped off, right? And you've got them both in one, and, I
now
laugh.
Now, wait a minute. She might also be doing the head chopping off. She might be the... Let's give her some credit.
The
she
dominatrix. The yeah. Yeah, well, I have a very personal experience of that dynamic or that sticky intersection, which I wrote about in Seen and Not Seen, with the video. I grew up with the video Nasty, which you probably know about. It was a phenomenon in the 80s. So it was Driller Killer and I Spit on Your Grave and Last House on the Left. 20 years later, it became known as torture porn with films like Hostel and whatnot.
Right.
But yeah, that was very much, I really got sucked into that rabbit hole, and was very... I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know why I was being turned on by these images, and I didn't resist it because I didn't have the moral framework to really question it. And I just told myself, well, it's just a movie. It's harmless, to get turned on or to masturbate over, these violent images. At the same time, I knew that it meant there was something wrong with me, So kind of, I turned it against myself in more ways than one, if you see what I mean, because I didn't have enough self-respect not to do it, but it intensified my sense of shame and guilt, and that there was something inherently wrong with me, even though it was something in the culture that was actually being packaged and marketed to me.
On a surface level, it's dehumanizing. And then that just ends up taking many different forms, from abortion to high-tech concepts of transhumanism. You name it. It runs the gamut. But it's ultimately dehumanizing in one way or another.
Yeah, and the body, the thing about a horror movie, and I do want to get specifics now, if possible, but yeah, the thing about the horror movie is the human body is being attacked. I mean, if there is no threat to the human body, then there's no horror, essentially. I mean, there are obviously different iterations. Cronenberg comes to mind, which is real body horror, or something more generic. The monster movie Jaws, it's still the same. I mean, it's essentially death, dismemberment, and torture. There's definitely quite a wide spectrum here, and we could see that some horror movies are relatively harmless, I would say, or relatively innocent, as compared to others. Right? So, and torture porn, and now we're in the age of the internet where kids can actually watch snuff movies. I don't think there can be any doubt that we're all the way at the demonic end of the spectrum there. So, how do you see it then? Just to bring it to specifics of this, on this spectrum, I mean, because it is very much about demonic possession and so on. So, what's your take on it in terms of not just what it's representing and what it's communicating, but how benign or how malevolent it is as a cultural artifact, starting with Stephen King's book, which I read in my, when I was 19, I think, and the movies and TV and all that. What's your overall take on this phenomenon?
Right, so let's just mention that it was a novel, then it was a two-part TV miniseries, and now it's been two movies. So that's three different formats of media to tell the same story. And what I find is virtually everything we've been discussing so far, it's in the It novel. There, all of it. It's astonishing how many elements of everything we've been discussing is in that novel. Now, one of the things King tends to write about is childhood trauma. So many of his stories. And let me just back up one step. I've never been much into Stephen King. Yeah, I watched some of the movies and that was about it. Read some of his short stories, but it's not like I've been a Stephen King fan. So for me, I find it interesting that every time I write a book, it can potentially be such a different experience. This one was definitely learning a lot along the way. So that's one of the things I came to realize is that he writes a lot about childhood trauma. And then the transition, which he calls mystical, into adulthood, and then consequently, how it is that the childhood trauma ends up affecting the child or the adult rather.
Yeah, and Dr. Sleep was one of his most recent ones, and it's the only one I've read of his recent ones, and that's all about that, because of course it's the sequel to the Shining.
Well, let me tell you, I had no idea what Dr. Sleep was. I figured I'd go watch it, and I figured it would be a very sort of a predictable The Shining Part Two, but it was an extremely different type of story. It was extremely brutal. I mean, it was truly unbelievable. But one aspect of that movie is traumatizing children in order to, I guess you would call those people psychic vampires, right? They're siphoning energy produced by the trauma that these children are suffering. And you see that also in Stephen King's Dark Tower. And of course, by the way, you see it in the children's movie, Monsters, Inc. That's the premise right there. You traumatize children and you derive a certain energy from it. And so what this causes in the story is that it solidifies childhood friendships because, as is the case in It, Derry is a styled haunted city. In other words, that's also seen in Stephen King's Castle Rock. In other words, the entire town or the entire city is in on it, implicitly or explicitly, either by covering things up or just ignoring them. In one way or another, everyone is aware that something is going on to different levels of awareness, and they do essentially nothing. And so, since the children are so traumatized, it forces them to build really close relationships with each other. And I think that's something a lot of people like, actually enjoy about Stephen King movies. Is they're deeply interpersonal. It's just that it just so happens, or maybe it just so happens isn't the right phrase because he's doing it on purpose. It is because of the trauma, but that's what makes it appealing is these wonderful friendships that result from the desperation of finding somebody with whom you can relate and who will not live their life to basically focus on you in a traumatizing way, but kind of help you through it. that's one thing that I think is really an enjoyable takeaway from those movies. The thing is, it's so horrendous along the way.
It's definitely the case with the books. I mean, I did watch the movie. I didn't like it very much, and I didn't watch the TV show. But I remember when I read the book at 19, which is really, you know, just entering into adulthood, and it's a huge book. It's over 1,000 pages. I remember how absolutely transported I was by the narrative of these kids growing up together in a small town, even though that didn't really correspond with my childhood. I mean, I did grow up in a small town, but I never had a gang or anything like that. I only ever had one friend, more or less. But something about it was so evocative. I remember how acutely it generated this feeling of nostalgia for childhood in me. Yeah, much more than the horror. I mean, as far as what captured me in the book.
Right.
Yeah.
And his tale, The Dreamcatcher, is exactly the same. It's broken up into childhood and then adulthood, and what the adults are dealing with due to their childhood.
Right.
And what was it? Well, it's drama and trauma and, you know, supernatural menace, or paranormal, I should say.
Hmm. Well,
Go
ahead.
That is another aspect, like I said, of a lot of his tales, which is that it's very much like when I was reviewing the Alien movie. When all the action takes place aboard a spaceship, it creates a sense of desperation because there's literally nowhere you can go.
Mm-hmm.
And so you feel the claustrophobia. You feel the helplessness. You literally can't go anywhere. It's literally do or die. That's all there is to it. You're going to survive or you're not, period. So it's very much like the case in Castle Rock or It with Derry, is when the whole town is infected by this thing, then that's what it causes also. Is it's not just like the children can up and leave. It's like they're literally stuck in this situation.
Right.
And it's a perish or flourish type of situation.
And that's very akin to childhood trauma or ancestral trauma, like in two senses. One can't escape it because it keeps getting passed down through the generations, and the other is that because it's in the body, you can't escape it. No matter where you go, the horror is inside you.
It's interesting you put it that way, because one thing that, like you were talking about, what's the genre of horror? Body terror?
Body terror is what Whitley Strieber, I was just about to mention him, what he was going to call communion. Body horror, I think, is the term used for Cronenberg, because his movies, you know, were so much about the horror of the body itself, never mind what might happen to it.
Right. I have heard that term, either body terror or body horror, used in terms of a subgenre of horror movies. That's why I mentioned it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing Stephen King mentions in one of his interviews, is that a lot of modern day horror movies are actually dealing with concepts of cancer, whether it's The Thing, right? John Carpenter, The Thing, where the end result is an amorphous biological mass that's just consuming you to death.
Hmm.
I mean, it's this horrendous simile of life that's just literally eating you up. Which, incidentally, is, if that's an accurate interpretation, it's another aspect of the symbolism we talked about earlier, is you think you're looking at a biological entity from outer space, where maybe the author or director is thinking in terms of something like a cancer.
Right.
For instance, in Stephen King's Dreamcatcher, there's a famous scene that takes place in the bathroom. And so Stephen King says, well, I had thought about, well, where haven't horror movies gone yet? They've gone everywhere. They've even gone into the bedroom. But what about the bathroom? And he said he thought about how the bathroom can be a very terrifying place, because that might be where a woman finds out she's got breast cancer. That might be where all kinds of biologically unpleasant things happen to us, right?
Right.
Where we're checking ourselves out, and what is this growth, and what's that, and you name it. So,
yeah, because I mean, that fundamental reality of death, of course, if and when we confront it, is very likely to be absolutely terrifying. I mean, hopefully not inevitably, but certainly, as you say, in circumstances where one is fully lucid and totally unprepared, and one discovers a growth, and it suddenly seems like one is about to die, or even if one is in a car accident and is about to die or thinks one is, the amount of terror there is perhaps unimaginable, potentially anyway, and yet it's completely ordinary, right? I mean, death, where it comes to us all. And right. So it's like the horror movie is dealing with the most fundamental terror that we have, the terror of annihilation, but it has to deal with it in these very elaborate ways, come up with these fantastic narratives as a way to actually make it unusual and compelling to audiences, and not too disturbing, ironically, right? Because actually a story about cancer is a lot more disturbing potentially than a story about a demon from outer space,
right? Because it's that much more realistic and relatable.
Yeah, it doesn't have any glamour around it. I mean, you know, like the thing with it you're describing there is that, because if Stephen King had just written a novel about kids growing up together, I mean, he did do that with Stamp the Body, but even there they find a dead body. If it's just that, then it just seems sentimental and you know, whimsical and so on. But when you juxtapose the two things together, they reinforce each other, of course. So there's something very glamorous and very romantic about not just kids growing up together, but kids facing, you know, the ultimate evil together. And so ultimate evil becomes this element that actually makes their lives epic and exciting, which of course is what we want when we go to the movies. We want to feel like we're part of something epic and exciting and not dreary and mundane.
Indeed, and a lot of people discuss why it was that in It, the Stan character commits suicide. So in the portion of the story where they're adults, once they are made aware that the It character has returned, and maybe we should take a step back and explain what we would mean by returned, Stan ends up committing suicide. There's a lot of discussion about why he did that. But to me, it's pretty obvious in the novel is that he was very much of a rationalist. And so having the childhood trauma of confronting something that was so utterly other, so literally offensive is the term that is used in the novel it offended him, not like one of these modern day feeling based I'm so offended at what you said, but feeling at such a fundamental level where it disrupted his worldview that he literally can't handle the concept anymore. He can't handle the fact that there is indeed a reality that is so beyond what his rational mind can conceive that he literally just commits suicide. He cannot handle his worldview being disrupted again as an adult like it was when he was a child, and he was traumatized by that.
Right. Well, that's very evocative of experiences I had as a child. I had night terrors as a child, and they were very hard to comprehend or describe or articulate by their very nature. But one of the ways that I did try to understand them at the time was exactly what you just said, that I woke up with the sense that I had encountered something that was so utterly incomprehensible to me that my whole sense of reality and meaning was gone. It just crumbled. Like I couldn't find the ground of who I was or what reality was anymore, because I'd had contact with something. It's kind of Lovecraftian, you know, something that was just so beyond my capacity to understand or endure that I kind of had this internal collapse. And fortunately I didn't get mad or commit suicide or anything like that. But I would either stagger through the house like gasping to myself, it can't be, or what's how I don't understand, you know, just in this state. Or on occasion I would actually get up and flee. Like I would be physically impelled to just run from the bedroom and run from the house, as if to get away from something that I had no conception of. Like I had no sense of what it was, except by its effects.
And this is exactly the concept Stephen King is playing upon in the It novel, and the very reason why it's referred to as It, because right. It is something so foreign, so other, that the minute you think you put your finger on it, you realize I didn't really put my finger on it. It is something else. It is not only something I find difficult to perceive, but it realizes this. And so what it does is plays upon your deepest fear and manifests itself to you as that. Right. So for example, why is it that it mostly manifests as Pennywise the Dancing Clown? Well, because there's a certain element of, at the very least, mystery, at the most, fear in a clown. Because even if you find clowns amusing and you're not scared of them at all, you still recognize, I'm not looking at the real thing. This is a put on. This is a show. This is a mask. This is a performance. This isn't a real thing. In the book, I'm naughty enough to correlate it to the drunk chick at a party, right? She's drunk. She's not acting as she would when she's sober. She's got way too much makeup on. You know that it's really kind of a messy situation. You're not looking at the real person,
right.
Not the way that they're going to look or sound or think or act when they're sober, right? So there's that sense of it. And what Stephen King does in the novel, okay, so let's start, if I may, go to the movies, basically 100% focused on Pennywise. Then at the end of the second movie, you see that they're battling it out with something that is somewhat beyond Pennywise. From the waist up, it's Pennywise. From the waist down, it's essentially Arachnid. And incidentally, let me throw this in. I found it extremely disturbing that in the second movie, you see an aspect of the novel, which is literally about magic with a CK, which is the battle of the wills. And that's really what it comes down to, is the traumatized children who return to Derry as adults are confronting it, and they recognize that it is about will. And so they're literally not fighting it with weapons. They are willing it to lose its power over them. And so they start taunting, oh, you're just a clown, ha ha ha. And then it starts losing its power, and it begins to shrink, the Pennywise character, until it is the size of a child or a baby, and also looking very much like an infant. And that's when they plunge their hands into its chest and literally rip out its heart. I just found that incredibly disturbing, that this is the ultimate victory, is pulling the beating heart out of a baby's chest. Hello.
I think that's in the book, is it?
No.
Because in the book, there's, I think it's pretty much the climax, but I remember for me it really jumped the shark. It was when they, there's one girl in the group and she says, she decides that they all have to have sex with her, or somehow it's decided that all the kids have to have sex with this one young girl, one by one. Basically an organized ritualistic gangbang.
That is straight up sex magic, and there's no question about it, because I'll grant you, I kind of skipped around that part because I found it incredibly uncomfortable. But he was very explicit that there was a transfer of energy from the boys to her and vice versa. It was obviously sex magic.
Yeah.
And so now in the end of the TV series, the Pennywise character is gone. They are seeing the thing behind the Pennywise character, which is a very much arachnid creature that they end up fighting. And yet, in the novel, that is not its ultimate form either. And so what Stephen King did is he decided to basically compile every single monster into one, which is why in the novel, what you don't see in the movie or the TV series is that it takes on the form of the teenage werewolf. You know, it'll take on the form of the mummy. Mm-hmm. It'll take on any form of anything that it knows is going to traumatize you.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the point is that you're never seeing the real thing. And that's why it's called It, because it's like a Lovecraftian concept of the unnameable.
Right,
it's something utterly foreign that our minds cannot wrap themselves around it.
Right.
And so, do you want to go at to the very core of what it is?
Well, figuratively speaking, I mean, we can talk about it. I just don't want to actually go there. I don't think I'm ready right now.
Yeah. Well, I think I might have asked you before if you're aware of the concept of the occult smiley face.
Yeah, that I think that was the thing that sparked this
correspondence.
Yeah.
So bottom line is my friend William Ramsey made me aware of this concept that I always think of it in terms of Sigmund Freud, right? He says sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Well, sometimes a smiley face is just a smiley face.
Mm-hmm.
But I started noticing it in tons of horror movies, which makes it completely uncontextual. Mm-hmm. So that makes me think, okay, there's something going on here. And in the It novel itself, it talks about, quote, a balloon with a smiley smile face was tied to one of the iron bars. The balloon bobbed and dipped in the faint breeze. And in the movie, you see that it begins, the first movie begins with one of the kids breathing on a window, so it becomes foggy, and then he draws a smiley face on it. So I'm like, okay, there it is. And now when you really understand what the smiley face, the occult aspect of it, is that alone tells you what the whole story is about.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to remember one of Aleister Crowley's pseudonyms, Frater
Petrarca, I think
that's the one.
Yeah, I endure.
Perdurabo.
There you go.
That's the one. William Ramsay being, I think, one of the premier Crowleyan researchers of our time, on the side of pointing out what a horrible person he was, incidentally, not being a fan.
Yeah.
He alerted me to the following quote, which, if you don't mind, I'll read.
Yeah.
This is from the Book of Lies. The universe is the practical joke and the general at the expense of the particular, quote, Frater Perturbado, and laughed. But those disciples nearest him wept, seeing the universal sorrow. Those next to them laughed, seeing the universal joke. Below these, certain disciples wept, and certain laughed. Others next wept, others next laughed. Next, others wept, next, others laughed. Last came those who wept because they could not see the joke, and those that laughed lest they should not, be thought not to see the joke, and thought it safe to act like Frater Perturbado. But though Frater Perturbado laughed openly, he also at the same time wept secretly, and in himself he neither laughed nor wept, nor did he mean what he said. Okay. Now, beyond anything else, what I get out of that is the concept that why the smiley face can be used as an occult symbol is the concept that the universe is just ultimately meaningless. So in other words, your entire life is a big joke.
Yeah, although that wouldn't be very funny, would it?
Well, it's almost like the way I think of it is you either laugh because you've realized that, or it's one of those laugh or cry situations.
Yeah.
Or something that is so incredibly shocking that it's a laugh of madness.
Right.
One thing I really liked about the end of the Lovecraft movie, oh my goodness, the one about the machine that activates the pineal gland. It's a movie from the 80s.
So not Reanimator, but the one after it? From Beyond, was it? Something
From
like
Beyond,
that?
Yes. Yeah. Now, at the end of the movie, the one woman who survived the horrendous experience throughout the movie, she just starts laughing maniacally.
Hmm.
Right? Because that's it. Her whole reality has literally fallen to bits. She's experienced something so beyond. She can do nothing else but just laugh maniacally. Well, that's it. It's gone.
That's the Joker.
Right. So this is the concept of the occult smiley face, and then you're looking at the concept of the Joker, the trickster, the clown.
Right.
Right, which it is, as Pennywise. And then, of course, you have the very, very popular character right now from Batman, the Joker.
Yeah.
Same kind of thing, the tragic clown, Pagliacci, right?
Right.
Now, you also, I know you're surely aware of the William Shakespeare line from Macbeth. This life, which has been the tomb of his virtue and of his honor, is but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Okay. Now, so that's another aspect of that big universal joke. Your whole life is sound and fury, signifying nothing. It's meaningless. Now, Stephen King places this line, or a paraphrase of it, into the mouth of it. It tells this to one of the children. So you cannot get away from the fact that this is the cosmology, as it were, of the tale that he wrote. And so if we get to the very bottom line that no movie or TV show dared to touch because it was just too abstract, what you have in the It novel is something Stephen King calls another or other. And we really don't know what that is, except that it appears to be the Deus Absconditus, if you know what I mean, the hidden god, right? A sort of deistic god.
Is it hidden or is he absent? That's because absconded.
It's definitely hidden.
It doesn't absconded suggest that he absconded, that he went away somewhere?
Well, so again, like in Spanish, escondido is
hidden,
hiding.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure there's much of a distinction in terms of that. The only time we are confronted with this being in the novel is once one of the children is literally flying through layers of reality into a completely different realm, beyond the universe, beyond anything. And so this, whatever it is, this other, creates what is described as a turtle and a spider. Okay, now the spider is why you end up having depictions of the It character as an arachnid, because that is one of the it's even hard to describe. It's not its fundamental form. It's called a spider because that is our best estimation of how to describe it. So it's not like it was created an arachnid, but that is the novel's best ability at naming it.
Right. It's like the eagle in Castaneda. Like there's some hyperdimensional entity that the closest correspondence we have in this organic realm is a spider or an eagle.
Right. Because ultimately, you have it generally choosing to manifest as Pennywise because it enjoys that very much. Now, it got that idea from a real life human being named Robert Gray, because you often hear in the novel that it is claiming, hey, I'm Robert Gray. Well, so apparently somewhere down the line, it encountered this human being who was a circus performer. He was a clown and he liked that. So he kind of took over that persona. But again, beyond that, there's something else. And ultimately, the way that King describes it is that it existed as a titanic glowing core, a thing of unshaped, destroying light, endless, crawling, hairy thing, which was made of light and nothing else. Orange light, dead light that mocked life. So even there, he describes it as light, but is also hairy. Now, how does light have hair? So even then, you recognize what Stephen King is trying to describe is something just undescribable. And so the other creates this thing that is called a spider, and then this thing called a turtle. Now, the spider just thinks the turtle is a big idiot and wants nothing to do with it, so it just goes off wherever it might have been. One day, the turtle gets an upset stomach and vomits. And that vomit is our universe. Okay, so that's the that's the fundamental cosmogony of the It tale, which is the universe is literally a joke. It's such a bad joke that it's turtle vomit. It wasn't even created volitionally, meaning with a goal in mind or a purpose. It literally is just a turtle got an upset stomach and vomited, and that's our universe. So that's the fundamental point, is the universe is literally that bad, right? And so let's say that you vomited. Would you be terribly interested about the goings on with the bacteria in your vomit?
Right.
Or would you be more likely to just wipe it up and throw it away? Well, what ends up happening in this story is that somehow the kids, actually not somehow, through a ritual, the smoke hole ritual, the kids become aware of this turtle's existence and they turn to it for assistance, but it denies it. It's just so disinterested. Why on earth would it be? Right? It says, don't blame me. I just got an upset stomach. Kind of like, what do you want me to get involved with you for? Mm. You're just a total accident. Mm. Although there are hints that it might not help them directly, but it does give them clues as to things that they should be doing, like the Chud ritual. Okay, so, and then at the end, also the only time we know anything about it is because it says something positive to the kids, like refers to him as, well done, my son, and stuff like that. That's about it.
Who's that?
The other.
So the other is a benign presence?
Well, see, that's the point. It's not exactly consistent.
Yeah.
Because all we know about it is that it created the turtle and the spider, and then that it seems to be pleased that the kids got one over on the spider, essentially.
Right.
But that's it. Then forget it. There's nothing more to be known about it. And so what the spider explains is that at some point he thinks that the turtle had died because it retrieved itself into its shell. And I guess just spent a few millennia doing that, so he thought it was dead and he doesn't care anyway. So it enters into the turtle vomit universe and it somehow ends up falling to Earth, like I said, in typical either alien form or aka I saw Satan fall to Earth as lightning form. It ends up on Earth, it lands in Derry, and what it found on Earth is imagination. So that's what it really enjoyed, is he could traumatize human beings. It particularly enjoyed that because they had the imagination that he could feed off of, so as to portray itself as their darkest fear.
Right.
Now, there's, I guess I'll just call it a conspiratorial concept, that people who drank blood for real, I don't mean these hipster vampire cults, I mean for real, the claim is that they enjoy inflicting trauma on their victims beforehand because it produces certain chemicals that end up in the blood, the most well-known being adrenochrome.
Yeah.
Well, that is in the It novel. It enjoys traumatizing its victims because it has an effect on the human meat.
Right. You know,
that's made very clear.
Right.
That's very obvious. And so that's why it enjoys Earth so much, because it found something it hadn't found anywhere else in the universe, which is this capability of imagination. And again, it is very much a tale about will, which is the bottom line of all magic, any definition of, I don't mean illusion magic, but magic with a CK, any working definition will touch upon the concept that is the imposition of will towards creating change in the real world. That's very much what it is about.
And yeah.
And so that is an extremely Gnostic type of cosmology, which is that the one true God is really removed, inaccessible and unknown, but it created lower gods, and then one of those lower gods created our universe. And in Gnosticism, our universe is fundamentally corrupt at an ontological level of its nature and essence because it's material, and to Gnostics, that is utter corruption. So the God that created this universe must have been senile and evil, and is also arrogant enough to claim to his creation that, hey, I'm the one true God. There's no other. And then you get into the whole concept of where that takes you, which is basically, if you take any biblical doctrine and turn it upside down, inside out and backwards, you get Gnosticism. But that's really what this whole tale behind it is about. And like I said, there's everything we talked about is in there. In fact, I did write one chapter called The MK Interpretation of It, which I admitted was extremely speculative. But I thought to myself, well, you know, another thing Stephen King has written a lot about is government ops, black ops, right? Government secret experimentation, mind control, torture, all those things. And I thought, well, I guess in my mind, an interpretation I played with is, what if this was really about the CIA's MK Ultra, or not necessarily MK Ultra, any of the slew of MK experiments? Because the novel is set in the 50s when MK started.
Mm-hmm.
It has some references to the military. It involves the whole town, which is the sort of thing that I think you would need. Maybe it's a military base, and maybe it's a small town, somewhat involved in hushing it up. And then the novel ends in the 80s, which would have been not too long after MK was allegedly closed down. But then you would have decades by then of these damaged, traumatized, mind-controlled people running around that town. So my theory was, again, just speculative, that this is actually what the kids are dealing with. They're dealing with trauma of mind control, and they're not actually interacting with an otherworldly entity. It's just kind of like I've speculated about Whitley Strieber, who he claims that he has been MKUltra mind controlled. And so my theory is, it's likely that he was made to think he was having experiences with these visitors, with these grays, but he's really not. Those are just his handlers pretending to be such. So anyhow, I thought I would throw that out there because it seemed to be a plausible concept that King was playing around with. But
yeah,
the other thing, one more thing I wanted to mention, because you mentioned the word possession in the context of it, and that is very clear in the novel also. It is extremely clear. For instance, when the Beverly character is being traumatized by her violent dad, she is making it very clear to him that this isn't really you. You let it in to you, right? You're letting it possess you. That's why you're treating me so horribly.
So that's like Twin Peaks and Bob then, isn't it?
It is, to the point where some speculate that that's where the Twin Peaks concept of this entity came from.
Hmm.
Because, you know, there is this kind of thing Stephen King does where he puts elements of one of his novels into another one.
Yeah.
It happens a lot.
Yeah.
It happens a lot. So people have speculated that the Twin Peaks is playing off of this concept, not to mention the thing I said I would talk about just a little bit, which is I refer to it returning. Well, it has a sort of hibernation cycle. It'll hibernate for roughly 27 years, and then it'll come back and feed for a while.
It's a Saturn cycle.
Well, and then it'll hibernate. And you have that in Twin Peaks also, which is why the TV show ended and came back 25 years later.
Yeah, it's almost the Saturn cycle, 27 years. Saturn, Satan, yeah.
Now, why would you... I'm curious, why do you correlate 27 with anything satanic? I mean, I have my ideas, but...
The planet Saturn takes 29 and a half years to come around, but around 27 years is when you start to feel the influence. So that's, astrologers have correlated the 27 club, all those celebrities or rock stars who died at the age of 27,
right,
with the Saturn return.
Interesting.
Wonder where you are, standing in your hall. I feel you.
It's hard to hang on and it's hard to let go. You won't be here at the end of the show. Just these blue feelings. Success, no one could care less. When it's new, I can confess. Do you, you understand me? It's hard to move on when some part of you knows. Good times will come, but not good times like those. Just these blue, blue feelings. I took a walk down below. I heard you laugh, and I saw your smile.
You mentioned Whitley Strieber. He's been on my mind a lot through this conversation. And the first time he came up was you were talking about the town in it and how it's like the whole town was in it and the whole town was kind of traumatized in some way. And that's something Strieber has said about his past, that, you know, when these memories started surfacing after the supposed communion event, he began to realize that something had been occurring to him throughout his life from his childhood on. That did seem to include some sort of military program, and that it affected other people, and that people he grew up with, bad things happened to them, is how he put it. And he described it as like a giant invisible fist had hit his town, and that, you know, the traumatic impact of that had ripples not only throughout his life but throughout the lives of all the people that he knew, that he grew up with. So that's one thing that's very, very close match, and again brings it back to trauma, this unnameable thing that haunts us and that takes any form that we project upon it. That's very close to, I think, to the narrative of it has that psychological subtext of how trauma functions, as in if we're carrying trauma around, we've got these internal fears, we will project them outward onto, you know, whatever we encounter, and therefore we will give energy to that thing. But the other thing that I think is even more tantalizing and disturbing is this idea of hyperstition, which is that by writing or by thinking or by imagining we can bring things into reality somehow, which of course is what occult rituals are about, spellcasting. And of course with Strieber we know very well that he went from a traumatized child to a Gurdjieffian, you know, spiritual seeker and involved in all kinds of strange things in his 20s that I write about in Prisoner Infinity, always a subject of some kind of covert intelligence program involving trauma, I think. And at a certain point he became a horror writer. He started writing horror fiction, and then at a certain point his horror fiction metastasized into reality, or at the very least he turned himself, he transformed himself from a fiction writer into a non-fiction writer, and I think thoroughly convinced himself, and I think not entirely wrongly, I think somehow his horror fiction did spill over into reality. I don't think he generated out of his imagination, but there's this weird symbiosis going on by which, and he himself writes about this, of course, that he became afraid when he was writing Communion and the other books, that he was creating a corridor in the collective psyche by which these beings could enter into reality. So, and that's similar to what King is writing about with it. So is King also doing something similar? Like, insofar as Whitley Strieber was traumatized and kind of harness to these covert agendas to become a administrator or a minister of interdimensional beings or other realities or whatever we're going to say there was is going on with Strieber. Is that also true of King? Even though he stayed within the realm of fiction, is he also serving as a conduit for these, whatever we're going to describe them as?
And there's another aspect of the It novel that ties into what you were just saying, which is the concept of amnesia.
Yeah.
Because what happens in the story is the kids are growing up in Derry. They have the It experience. They fight it, but they don't kill it, but it goes into hibernation. So that means that they have roughly 27 years, right? Of peace, basically.
Right.
And so what happens is, as adults, six of the seven move away from Derry, and then one remains in Derry. Now, the one that remained in Derry, he has his full memory of his childhood experiences, whereas the six that moved away from Derry have complete amnesia, almost 100% amnesia.
Mm.
To the point where, if you remember, the novel begins with a boy being killed, and one of the boy's brothers is one of the main protagonists. He had literally forgotten that his brother was murdered.
Mm.
Or he had like a vague memory that he died.
Right.
But he really couldn't put his finger on what had happened. And so what happens is, once Mike, who is the one that remained in Derry, once he discerns that It is back, he calls the other six, and the second he starts talking to them about Derry and It, it's almost like one of these post-hypnotic suggestions. All of a sudden, their memories come rushing back.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that.
Right. And so another aspect that's close to what we've been talking about is that the six became very successful in life.
Hmm.
And so like I was saying, I didn't know much about King, and certainly not this story. So when I started thinking about it is when I started going through the novel, and I would try to come to conclusions and had many of them confirmed as I continued my research. And one of them was the concept of the Faustian bargain.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was something about their interaction with It that caused them to become very successful in life. Hmm. Which they were completely unaware of course. They're just living their lives with amnesia and becoming successful.
Right.
But I had thought in those terms. I wonder if that is some kind of Faustian bargain where, you know, the stereotypical tale that you make a deal with the devil, and
mm-hmm.
For a limited amount of time you gain riches and fame, and then of course you have to pay the piper.
Yeah, well, you could certainly speculate that about Stephen King, couldn't you, in terms of the weird particularly the incident with the truck. Like, he wrote a novel about possessed trucks, and even had his directorial debut, Maximum Overdrive, about these evil yes. trucks, and then he gets almost killed and dismembered by a truck on the highway. I mean, that's like something out of a horror movie in itself, isn't it?
True.
In terms of that power, I mean, William Burroughs warned about this, the power of the imagination that a writer harnesses to unleash forces that then, well, collect their due in some way.
And so the thing is, within the novel, It makes it very clear when they're bettering It, when It realizes that it's in deep trouble and it is actually in danger.
Hmm.
It offers that. It offers a styled Faustian bargain to the kids. I will make you rich. I'll make you successful. It says that. It makes it very clear. And another odd aspect of it is, one thing that had happened to the six that moved away from Derry is none of them had children.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And the novel doesn't really explain why that was, but it is just one of those true oddities.
Mm. Like, they've become possessed by It in some way, or extensions of It. And then it called them back.
So one of the things that is made clear in the novel is, again, keeping in mind the context is a battle of the wills. One of the reasons that it somehow caused them to become successful is so that they would be preoccupied with the mundane things of this world, like business and fame and money, so that they would no longer be putting their powerful wills against it. They wouldn't be coming back to Derry to battle it again. They wouldn't be focused on it, thinking about it, battling it. They would be so concerned with the mundane things of this world that it would be safe. And that's the reason that it somehow managed to affect their adult life, even away from Derry, is it wanted to be rid of them. And this also is a very Gnostic type concept, right? Is we're so wrapped up in the material realm that we don't recognize that ultimate salvation is to leave the material world. Well, how do we do that? Well, for us humans, it's death. So in Gnosticism, death is beneficial because you get to leave this material realm. And incidentally, that's what, at the beginning of the book, that's what I'm quoting Richard Stanley as talking about, that this is the bottom line of why Hollywood is the way it is, because it wants to speak to your subconscious that deconstruction is the ultimate salvation. Death is salvation. In that sense, incidentally, one thing I mentioned in the book, that's, you know, if you really want to get to the black and white harsh reality, the hero of the story is really it, not the kids, because the kids are preventing it from committing murders. But murder would be actual salvation, because it is removing people from this fallen, corrupt material realm that's evil, and is liberating their souls to go to the perfect realm of spirit. It's really a twisted way to think about it, but when it comes to the bottom line, that would be the consistent interpretation of it, which is it is the savior.
Has Stephen King said anything to confirm that, or is there anything about his personal worldview that you think confirms that?
The thing about Stephen King is he holds to what I would call a pragmatic theology, strictly pragmatic. He says that he believes in God because it helps him make sense of things. That's pretty much it.
That's like Jordan Peterson's prescription.
It's more like a conceptual thing, right? Yeah. So, no, what that means in terms of how he views life and death, I mean, we could talk a little bit about his politics, but and his concern that maybe what happens to advanced civilizations is they kill each other off, and that's where we ultimately headed. But I'm not sure if he's made a blunt statement about how death is the ultimate salvation and that's what it is doing. But when I tie all the pieces together, when I build this puzzle of what this story is saying, again, if I'm going to be brutally consistent, I have to conclude that it is a beneficial character because it's removing people from this corrupt world. There's no way that you would really understand that from the novel, obviously, because the victors are the kids who then come back as adults, minus Stan, who committed suicide, and they end up defeating it, and they're the heroes. There's no question about that. That's what the novel's about. I'm just saying, if I peel back to the darkest occult aspect of it, is that you can look at it in a very, very different way.
Well, it's also like I was talking about at the beginning of the different sorts of propaganda. There's the message, and then there's the medium, right? So if the message of it, if it's not consistent with the medium, in other words, if the spirit of it, and if King himself was more aligned with this worldview as you describe it, that actually is central to its meaning or its worldview, then the novel would be a kind of propaganda for it. It would be glamorizing and glorifying not redeeming, because redemption is a positive thing, but presenting it as the only alternative. I mean, it's the most transcendental thing in the novel. I guess you could also look at it that way. It's almost like, you know, Satan is, or it, or whatever, is the most powerful force in that universe, which, of course, is Gnostic again.
Right. Now, Tommy Lee Wallace is the one who directed the TV series about it. And he stated, magic is the true business of show business. And now, the dedication that Stephen King wrote to the novel It reads this way: this book is gratefully dedicated to my children. Kids, fiction is the truth inside the lie, and the truth of this fiction is simple enough. The magic exists. Now, I would love to sit down with Stephen King and tell him, can you define each one of these words for me? Because what on earth are you telling your children about how this bit of fiction that you wrote in It is the truth inside the lie? And that the truth of this particular bit of fiction is, now get this terminology, the magic exists. Now, you see why I'm emphasizing that. It's not that he said the truth of this fiction is simple enough, that magic exists. He's saying the magic exists. So he's pointing to a very specific magic that he's claiming actually exists. Now, what that is, I don't have a clue. I could easily say that he's obviously occultic or Gnostic or whatever, but I don't know.
Well, I mean, again, he's dedicated a novel to his children, and in which a bunch of children all have sex, you know, with the same female child, and it's a sex magic ritual. Maybe that's the magic that he's referring to. I mean, I don't want to make any leaps here, but certainly it's not hard to join those dots, is it? It's quite disturbing implications.
Yeah, in fact, he obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about that
scene,
the sex scene, and why, of course, the TV series and the movies didn't dare go there.
Right.
Of course, you know, wants to.
Yeah.
Now, this is what Stephen King stated about that scene. I wasn't really thinking of the sexual aspect of it. The book dealt with childhood and adulthood, 1958, and grown-ups. The grown-ups don't remember their childhood. None of us remember what we did as children. We think we do, but we don't remember it as it really happened. Intuitively, the losers, that's what the kids called themselves, the Losers Club, the losers knew that they had to come together again. Intuitively, the losers knew they had to be together again. The sexual act connected childhood and adulthood. It's another version of the glass tunnel that connects the children's library and the adult library. Times have changed since I wrote that scene, and there is now more sensitivity to those issues. But I wanted to read that because exactly what you said, that he's dedicating this to their children, to his children, and in his mind, apparently, look, the Losers Club, those kids in the novel were right around 11 years old. So I guess in Stephen King's mind, 11-year-olds having multiple sex partners is the way that you go from childhood to adulthood. I guess that's supposed to make some kind of sense to his real life advice to his kids or something.
That would be the question to ask Stephen King if you ever get a sit down. Is that what you meant, Steve?
Right. I mean, because. Is that really how you're thinking of the sex act between children, multiple, six of them, well, minus, no, Stan was there too. Seven, six boys taking turns with one girl at roughly 11 years of age. That is some sort of transition from childhood to adulthood, I guess.
Yeah.
But again, as we talked about earlier, it is absolutely clear that it is a sex magic ritual. It's not that the kids thought of it that way in the novel, but that's the way it's described. So there's something even deeper going on here.
Yeah. I have to go pretty soon.
Me too.
This whole conversation, I've been thinking of something, and I just wanted to share it. I mean, it might not be the point to end on, because it could open up a whole other can of worms. But I had this dream in my early 30s, and I won't be able to do justice to it without going and finding and reading it, but I'll just try and sum up the gist of it. It was one of those kind of all night long epic visionary type dreams, and it concerned the Jack the Ripper murders, and I went back in time and I was investigating, or I was watching an investigation of the Jack the Ripper murders, and I noticed that wherever Jack the Ripper had committed a murder, a flower had grown, and that this flower was an alien spore or a virus that was taking over the planet. And that it did so via Jack the Ripper was this agenda. It wasn't just an individual, but it was this organized agenda to spread this psychic virus, this alien psychic virus, via these extreme acts of violence and brutality against women that would be heavily publicized. And in other words, to create this narrative, the whole Jack the Ripper narrative, by committing these hideous acts of murder. And the alien virus, I realized at a certain point, was Satan. And I can't really make this dream coherent without referring back to all my notes, and even then it was beyond my capacity to really understand it. But one of the things that the insights I had, or the one of the elements of this dream narrative, was that the way that Satan returned to Earth and took possession of our collective human psyche was through fiction. That he had to infiltrate us through the imagination, and then he would internally colonize us. And so this virus was the Jack the Ripper virus, was the satanic virus that would be mimetic. Like, the more violence we would see and the more horror we would experience and imbibe through these stories, the more we would be possessed by it, and so Lucifer, Satan, would gradually take over the whole human psyche. Yeah. So, like I said, I've been thinking about it the whole time, because it seems like it's so close to the IT narrative.
So it's like a psychic version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah, it was an obvious reference to that with the flower. Like, it was like, of course, my own unconscious was picking up different elements from fiction that I'd read. And even Alan Moore, some of his ideas, and Neil Gaiman's Sandman, this idea that archetypal entities continue to exist in an increasingly rationalist, materialist world through our fictions. Right? But they actually do exist in that realm. It's not like they live in the book or the movie per se, but they live in the symbiosis between our own consciousness and those artifacts. And then they grow stronger and bigger. Like, the more people watch them, the more times it gets published, the more it's read, the more movies and TV shows are made, the more it becomes a modern archetype. Of course, the last Freddy Krueger movie was about this as well. The more it actually comes to exist in the physical realm, but through us. It's like it incarnates. It's like Satan incarnating through us and through our imaginations.
Yeah, in fact, Stephen King was asked why he's not going to write a follow-up to It, and he said, "I don't think I could bear to deal with Pennywise again. Too scary, even for me." Which you think is an odd thing to say about a character he literally just invented. It is nothing but fiction.
Yeah, well, maybe he's getting old now, so maybe he's you know, feeling the weight of it and leaning towards repentance, so to speak.
Well, if that is the case, then that would explain Dr. Sleep in terms of exposing, you know, cults of elitists that go around traumatizing children for their energetic purposes or what have you. Mm.
Changes in the heart, change with the times. Strangers in the night pass up and downtown.
That's the end of my conversation with Ken Ami. If you want to know more about his work, you can click on the link in the show note. It's hard to do a spiel when I'm just pre-recording these podcasts and I'm just doing one after the other. I feel like I can't possibly just keep saying the same thing over and over again, so I won't. I'll just say thanks for listening, and if you like this podcast, tell all your friends. Share it, I dare you.
The changes in the heart change with the times. Changes in the heart change with the times. Strangers in the night pass up and downtown. Changes in your soul. Changes in the heart.